This is The Rotunda, your podcast about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes.
If the judiciary doesn't think that we have the right to impeach judges, we're going to impeach judges, and we did. If the executive is going to encroach upon our ability to oversee and have accountability, we're going to sue agencies, and we're going to win, and we did.
The extended session ends with House Speaker Richard Corcoran winning big while Governor Rick Scott's priorities goes up in smoke, alongside two buds.
Ben Pallera is officially Frito now. And looks like John Morgan, my good friend, has decided to throw him under the bus, so to speak.
Instead of a bus, it appears it's an ice cream truck that's being used in the trial of former Congresswoman Corrine Brown.
You know, the people have been so supportive, so I decided I would bring my favorite ice cream truck out and give them ice cream.
And we're getting all the scoops from Jacksonville Times Union reporter Nate Monroe.
You know, the rules of criminal court do not require that she prove her innocence, and frankly, she didn't prove her innocence.
All that and more coming up on episode 105 of The Rotunda. Kick things off with a celebration, an annual tradition where the Florida Legislative Black Caucus and the Florida Hispanic Legislative Caucus and everyone else in between who gathered at the Moon Nightclub in Tallahassee to get down the last night before session ends. But it was chaos in the midst of the celebration. Session was extended by 3 days due to breakdowns in the deal-making process, but overall lawmakers did agree to an $83 billion spending plan, ignoring Governor Rick Scott's demands.
So in Enterprise Florida, go back to economic development, you get 5 times your money back. We put money in a project, we're guaranteed a return, it's 5 times. With Visit Florida, we're guaranteed that year $3.20 back for every dollar we spend.
That we don't mind that you veto.
So you actually might want the governor to veto, hopefully.
We might, it depends. Mm-hmm. We got to see it first.
Senate Minority Leader Oscar Brainin tells reporters he doesn't mind if Governor Rick Scott vetoes the budget.
They know that I need to see it before that happens. And he's got the line on a veto. What if he doesn't veto anything that, what if he only vetoes the bad stuff?
So you're like, show me the money.
Show me the money.
Show me the money.
Show me the money. No, more importantly, like, for instance, I'm trying to think of something that's terrible. Schools of Hope. Let's say he vetoed Schools of Hope. I don't know, let's think of something else that's terrible. Maybe Best and Brightest.
But what's in it for the people when you look at the issues Floridians most care about? Education, the environment, healthcare, medical marijuana. 74% of voters approved a ballot measure in 2014 to steer more money towards conservation. But lawmakers didn't set aside any money for the Florida Forever land buying program. Environmentalists are upset. However, Senate President Joe Negron is passionately claiming victory for another environmental issue, one that diverts polluted water from Lake Okeechobee.
Senate Bill 10 has been talked about for 2 decades. Talk, study, talk more, go to conferences, roll out ideas, put things in 2028, way down the road. And this legislature said, no, we're going to fund and plan for and organize southern storage, 100 to 120 billion gallons of storage south of the lake. You know that people said it was never going to be done. I remember reading articles at the beginning of session. The thing was put on life support 5 times in blogs, and we continued to work and work to get it done. So that was an enormous priority that we were able to convince our friends in the House to do.
Despite pledges of transparency, House Speaker Richard Corcoran negotiated many parts of the budget with Senate President Negron. Here's what he had to say when reporters grilled him about the failed promise.
I've said it 1,000 times. It's the most open and transparent. Okay, so tell me a time when for the first time, we list in our budget every single project. Finally, for the first time, projects were all known prior to the entry into conference. There was not one single late night addition to the conference in conference to the budget. These are things that have never taken place before in the history of Florida.
And that's just a taste of our session recap. Now everyone is waiting to see what Governor Rick Scott will do. Will he just use his line item veto power or scrap the entire budget, forcing lawmakers back to the Capitol? Will Scott attempt to measure up to Speaker Corcoran, who has successfully dominated the session. We'll be watching how it all plays out. This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes. You know, I'll admit, I probably need to watch The Godfather. I've seen bits and pieces over the years, but knowing the movie would have certainly helped me to understand Attorney John Morgan's recent Twitter rant.
There's a plane waiting for us to take us to Miami in an hour. They'll make a big thing about it. I knew it was you, Fredo. You broke my heart. You broke my heart.
71% of Floridians voted in favor of having medical pot in the Sunshine State. It was up to the legislature to come up with a plan to implement it this session. But that plan went up in smoke along with a friendship between the two chief advocates of medical pot. If you haven't started yet, follow Attorney John Morgan on Twitter and you'll find his calls for a special session and his kiss of death reference.
So, what do you know about Fredo?
Oh, you mean the brother of Corleone who slept with the fishes?
Mm-hmm.
Gary Stein calls himself a citizen advocate. He's been heavily tracking the medical marijuana debate. He's constantly blogging and posting videos detailing the changes all over social media.
Yeah, apparently, Ben Pallera is officially Fredo now, and looks like John Morgan, my good friend, has decided to throw him under the bus, so to speak, because he was working, apparently, for Florida for Care, which was the lobbying arm of United for Care that got Amendment 2 passed, and apparently he was working with the Golden Ticketers and the Golden Ticket wannabes in a way to make certain that they maintain that aspect of control over the market.
So let me understand the terms, the Golden Ticketers, and are they, what I've been reading are as the cartels, been described as the cartels?
The word cartel has been used. I kind of hate that word because when you associate it with cannabis, you associate it with Mexican smugglers and bandits who would want to put, you know, 10 skulls in a duffel bag. And we're trying to break away from the whole concept of cannabis as a street drug. It's not a street drug. It never has been a street drug. It was at one point in time just a dalliance like alcohol, and the alcohol became much bigger. But right now we're trying to concentrate on it as medicine. In order to concentrate on it as medicine, we need, you know, number one, we need to change our lexicon. We need to stop using the word marijuana altogether. That's difficult because it was put into U.S. law in 1937.
What should we call it? What should we use?
We should use the word cannabis. Cannabis was the name that everybody in the world knew it by, even back in the 1880s, when it was on the U.S. pharmacopoeia. It was called cannabis indica, cannabis sativa extract. That's what we used to call it. The only people who called it marijuana at the time were Mexican immigrants who had come over here from the Mexican Civil War. The peasantry used to call it marijuana just as a slang name, like we use the word weed or pot or that kind of thing. It really has no English translation.
This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes, chatting with citizen advocate Gary Stein.
The bill that was moving through the legislature is dead.
Absolutely.
What happened?
When it all came down, what they were calling it on the House side was a poison pill in the bill. So when it came down to negotiations, the House wanted an infinite number of dispensaries to be used for any of the things in order to keep the market open, because they are actually keeping this vertical integration, which really doesn't keep the market open, but it makes it appear as if it's far more open. And the Senate had said, no, we need to keep the cap at 3, because any entity that has multiple dispensaries in every city can actually choke out any new business.
Mm-hmm.
So the Senate, Bradley actually first heard about this cap from Artillis, who was not here to see his bill actually go through, unfortunately.
Yeah, he's been getting into other issues.
But Negron really, really liked the idea of caps, and so he was pushing to make certain that it happened that way. So Bradley, being the soldier that he is, said, okay, we'll go ahead and get it, but let's try to keep that cap at no more than, say, 5. He started at 3, and then he said, all right, let's go up to 5 in order to acquiesce to the House position. And Ray Rodriguez said, well, if we're going to say 5, or then I'm going to say 50. Now, it's not usual that you, in negotiations, you multiply the first offer by 10 and say, that's my offer. But when he got even more pushback, he multiplied that order by 2 and threw in another delete and said, everybody will have up to 100. So if we only had 7 dispensing organizations, that would mean 700 dispensaries from only 7 companies. Yeah. That is not a free market. That is squelching in a free market. And the actual House bill allowed for 10 more dispensing organizations to occur in the next 2 years. That means out of 17 industries, 1,700 dispensaries would be occurring from a very small amount of people. Mm-hmm. And the Senate said, this can't happen. This is ridiculous. And they decided they weren't going to go with it.
So that's how it's been going. But now we're seeing there's a call for a special session by John Morgan and this very public breakup between Frito, Ben Pallara, and Morgan. So there's a call to not even fund Pallara anymore by John Morgan. What's at stake? What will happen next? It's up to the DOH, Department of Health, to decide this. Can they, from your standpoint, go forward with this?
Okay, as far as the DOH is concerned, yes. Right now, the status quo is the DOH is in charge. They have until July 1st, to, according to the amendment, to go ahead and get the rules established and have them approved. So there has to be hearings for those rules to be approved. If they don't do it, within 9 months, we can start suing, according to the amendment. And litigation takes time, it takes money. I hate to go it that way. Mm-hmm. As far as a special session is concerned, I think it's very wishful thinking on our good friend John Morgan's part, but you know the cost of putting together a special session. And if the budget has already been is cooling off right now and it's finished, why would they go back into special session for one issue that will cost the taxpayers millions of dollars to reopen the legislature for a short period of time? It's not going to happen.
Thanks to citizen advocate Gary Stein. This is The Rotunda, your podcast about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes. Visit rotundapodcast.com, follow us on social media at Rotunda Podcast, and dig deep by supporting this weekly production. Yes, you can send in your generous contribution of any amount by visiting rotundapodcast.com. And as always, thanks for your support.
About $1,500, she would have been in the red without all of these cash deposits that the government says were unreported and that stemmed from illegal activity.
Not guilty, that's all. Not guilty.
The trial of former Congresswoman Corinne Brown is near end. The over-the-top, colorful personality was on full display.
It's a sight we did not expect to see today. You see it right here. Former Congresswoman Corinne Brown passing out ice cream. Yeah, ice cream ahead of her federal court appearance.
Even after the judge requested that Brown stay out of the media spotlight, she had this to say to a gaggle of reporters.
The truth is what we need. So I'm ready. I want this to be behind me, a chapter in my life. This needs to be over.
Florida Times Union reporter Nate Monroe has been tracking the case with his colleagues, and he's here to share the highlights.
All right. So, Nate Monroe, you have been covering the trial of former U.S. Representative Corinne Brown, the 12th term congresswoman that has found herself in some legal wranglings over a questionable charity that was set up by her staff. Bring us up to speed on where things are.
Yes, she is facing a number of fraud and tax charges related to One Door for Education, which is a sham nonprofit. It was set up by the girlfriend of her former chief of staff, and prosecutors say that that this nonprofit, instead of being a charity that helped needy kids, was essentially a slush fund that that her chief of staff and his girlfriend and that the congresswoman essentially lived on for several years. And what we saw over the course of about a week and a half of testimony and evidence was that the government presented a pretty substantial case. They talked to donors to the nonprofit who had been solicited by Corinne Brown personally. They talked to members of Corinne's staff who testified that Corinne was aware of One Door that she had handed them. She was in possession of, at times, blank One Door checks. And, you know, in terms of a defense, I mean, Corinne was essentially relying on her own ability to defend herself. She took the stand. That testimony lasted about 2 days. We're done with the evidence portion of the trial, so we'll come back on Monday and hear closing arguments, and then the jury will go deliberate.
What do you mean that she was depending on her own ability to provide a defense?
Corinne has a reputation for having a very colorful personality, and is also, frankly, in her fundraising efforts and as a politician, been very persuasive. You don't win 12 elections without sort of having that like force of personality. And really, the almost the totality of her defense was her taking the stand and trying to explain, you know, kind of explain away these charges. You know, the rules of criminal court do not require that she prove her innocence. And frankly, she didn't prove her innocence. This sort of varying explanations that she gave and her kind of lack of memory about One Door at times, whether that raises enough doubts in the minds of jurors, again, like that's something they'll have to decide. But, you know, her defense really centered around her.
What I'm reading from your coverage, like, you know, she doubled down many times when prosecutors asked where the cash came from. One quote I saw, she said she had birthdays, she had Christmas, and sometimes she had boyfriends. What were other things that she said during the course of this trial that stood out for you?
And so she made those comments in reference to a number of deposits. Often they were cash deposits that went into her account and that the FBI was able to identify as having come either from One Door or from other sources. She has gotten money deposited in her account that originated from her campaign committee. She had a former staffer who used some of her own funds in one case to deposit money into Corinne Brown's account. And she sort of gave varying explanations for where all this money came from. You know, when prosecutors would ask about deposits that were made with money from her aide's account, her explanation was that she had loaned the aide money over a course of several years and that aide was paying her back. In the case of One Door, she said, well, I don't know why that was being deposited in my account. I had assumed that my chief of staff was depositing reimbursements in my account. There was money that she really couldn't explain. There were deposits made into her account with One Door money that she just simply had to say, I don't know. And that's when she got into, well, you know, I have birthdays and people give me gifts and maybe I needed a loan from somebody at some point. And that sort of, you know, again, it was kind of this hodgepodge of like different explanations.
So it makes me wonder, like, what was her financial situation like? Was she not making enough money as a congresswoman? Did she get some bad investments? Like, what drove this need to rely on One Door for her personal wealth?
Well, so prosecutors have said that the drive was that she has simply developed a taste for luxury, that she was trying to live beyond her means, that she liked shopping, which was a point she actually conceded when she was testifying that she does like shopping. You know, and so the prosecutors say, look, she liked going to Beverly Hills and, you know, going to Neiman Marcus and Macy's, and she just simply lived beyond her means. She had three mortgages in her name. She has a townhouse in Washington, D.C. that she shares with her daughter. She has a house here in Jacksonville on the Trout River on the north side. And she has a house in Fernandina Beach, which she shares with her brother. And really all of that just adds up to a substantial amount of bills. I did not see any suggestion that she had sort of made any sort of like bad investments or that she owed some huge loan that she had taken out. It was really more just she was spending more money than she was taking in. And, you know, an FBI analyst at one point went through a chart that they had prepared that showed that without the cash deposits that had been made into her account over the last several years from about 2010 to 2015, that she would have run deficits in her account every month. And the average about $1,500, she would have been in the red without all of these cash deposits that the government says were unreported and that stemmed from illegal activity.
All right. Well, Nate Monroe, thank you so much for the update. And I know you're going to be on top of this to the end as we find out the results and what will ultimately happen in this case of former Congresswoman Corinne Brown.
Thanks.
It is time to turn the tables on the Tallahassee politicians. Yesterday, I followed in my father's footsteps and I did a work day right there at Carroll City Senior High.
So it was a busy news week. Former Congresswoman Gwen Graham is officially in the race for governor with her campaign announcement in Miami.
With my experience as a working mom, as a PTA president, as a public school official, and finally serving Florida in Congress, I am so proud to announce that I am running to serve as Florida's next governor.
Graham joins fellow Democrats Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum and Orlando businessman Chris King. As for Republicans, Florida Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam is in the race, and we're still waiting to see if House Speaker Richard Corcoran will follow suit. Now that session is almost out of the way. That's it for this edition of The Rotunda. Remember to follow us at Rotunda Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Also, check us out at rotundapodcast.com, where you can also send in your generous contribution. We want to hear from you always with your story ideas, and be sure to join us next week for more stories about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes.